Welcome to the DBS Films Podcast, a behind-the-scenes look into making indie films. Learn from DBS Films about their process, tips, and fun stories that all come with making multiple movies a reality.
Hey everyone, and welcome to DBS Films Podcast. My name is Kellen, and with me as always my brother Brendan, and together we make movies with DBS Films. Today we're going to hop into part two of our series on basically looking at the first eight movies we made, talking about three things we did pretty well, three things we did not do very well at all, but more importantly, what we learned from this process. And honestly, I feel like it's really powerful for us to just kind of boil it down because, you know, the best thing you get from completing a movie is really the experience, more so than how the final product does, more so than, you know, how it really ends up getting out there is what you can continue to take with you, which is the experience. So before we hop right into it, you know, as always, we have The Girl in Cabin 13. It is something that you can watch it now for free on Tubi. Also, be sure to check out our Discord channel. We got a ton of super fans. We just crossed 500 members in our Discord, which was quite a little milestone. And also, we're about to hop into filming. You know, by the time you guys hear this, we will actually be on set for our latest feature. And if you want to see how it's going, you're going to get day-by-day updates in that Discord. So hopefully you tune in, hopefully you follow us, and hopefully you guys join our community because it's growing bigger and bigger every day. So Brendan, before we start, what's your overall opinion on, again, the benefit of completing a movie and how it really just fills in a lot of gaps and gives you a tremendous amount of experience? And what's really the importance of both the positive and the negative things that happen on set and what you can learn from them?
I mean, you just have to finish things. I always bring it up. The most important thing that I have, the most valuable thing that I have currently as a filmmaker is my portfolio. And that's the eight movies. Well, it's essentially the 10 movies that I've completed, I've uploaded, and I've gotten feedback from not only friends and family, from the super fans and the people that, you know, are part of our Instagram and our TikTok and our Discord communities. And I've also gotten feedback from distribution and other producers. That feedback is super valuable because I am actively taking it to either edit the next movie, I'm including it in the script, and I'm trying to make the movies better. And having feedback from all three of those different groups, because it is different feedback. Friends and family will obviously be a little bit nicer. The super fans obviously love our stuff, but they give very detailed feedback. The feedback that we got for The Murder House has been absolutely exceptional. And then the distribution companies are looking for, you know, things that they can sell or they can market the movie. So having all three of those tranches of feedback is extremely valuable. And once again, you only get that if you complete movies. If you don't complete a movie, or if you have these things essentially in filmmaker purgatory, you're going to have problems and you're never going to be able to learn. You're never going to be able to make essentially the next step.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, really the biggest thing to me is more so than, you know, making the best product. Like, I think a lot of filmmakers fall into this trap of trying to make the best vision, the perfect, you know, story that they've had in their head, and they don't budge on, you know, the budget. They don't, you know, compromise here and there. When we say it multiple times, filmmaking is compromise. That's all it is compromising what you can actually write and film, what you can actually make with the footage you got, and what you have to do in the editing. All of it is compromising on what your vision is. And I feel like a lot of filmmakers have a vision in their head and they don't compromise on it, and they get stuck and they never have a finished product and they don't learn from it. Whereas if they would take the same amount of time and, you know, divvy up the resources as much as possible, they would get much more experience out of it. And, you know, again, it's something where there's so many little things, so many tiny little things that we've learned from every single production. More importantly, you just get more comfortable. You know, as we're going into our next shoot, we're very, you know, we've done this before. This is not our first time. So we understand where we're at and, you know, we're just feeling comfortable with it. Now, that being said, you know, you learn from all the little things. We want to go ahead and take a look at the top three things that we did well and the top three things that we did not do. So we left off on The Whitlow House. Again, that's one of our favorites. And then we ended up going into our found footage two series with Into the Forest and The Haunting of the Suicide House. You know, I think at this time we were really kind of like, okay, Unseen did really good right now. We have the Whitlow House, but let's do found footage. Let's do found footage. If you've listened to our episodes on found footage, I'm not the biggest fan of it. However, I think everyone should do it. And also with that and the super fans basically telling me that found footage was great, I'm back on the found footage. You know, I will not let the data end up swaying me. I will appreciate it. And yeah, they like found footage. So we're looking at doing found footage again. We're looking at actually revisiting this idea. So Into the Forest, Brennan, what's your overall, you know, feelings and just how do you like that when it comes to the saga of the first eight?
Well, Into the Forest was our first found footage movie. I didn't know what we were going to get into with found footage. We learned a lot, and there's definitely some issues with just shooting that in general. But I think the main takeaways from found footage, and I'll just start to go into the three things that I essentially learned, was, you know, found footage, you know, the fans of found footage really like the genre. They like found footage, and they're willing to essentially forgive a lot of issues, especially technical issues. So found footage is supposed to be gritty. You know, the light's not supposed to be properly exposed at certain times. The audio can be off a little bit. And they're completely willing to forgive these issues and focus on the storyline. And so this is the first thing that I learned from the, you know, doing Into the Forest, was that the feedback was, for the first time in our history of DBS Films, the feedback was generally in response to the story. It was in response to the characters, the character development, and the overall story, as opposed to pointing out audio issues or technical issues or video issues, which we struggled with before. So I think my first thing was, you know, found footage allows you to shoot a whole movie and then get feedback, not on technical issues, which most indie people or most indie filmmakers struggle with. They focus on just your story, your characters, and your character development. So that was the first thing that we learned. It was like the feedback we're getting was based on the story. The next thing was, like, woods in the forest at night is super creepy. It's something that's very scary. If you have a flashlight and you're in the woods, everything looks really, really good. It's the flashlight glow only illuminates for a little bit before it dims, and you have this essentially like an ellipsed backdrop of the forest, so it looks kind of creepy, and you can do a lot of pop scares and people can come out of the woods. It's very scary. So that'd probably be the second thing that we learned. And then the third thing was, essentially, like, if you're gonna do found footage, you have to have really good actors. And working with the actors that we had in Into the Forest was like a learning experience with us, because they have to do these long extended scenes without essentially breaking. They can't struggle with lines, or they can't, mess up any lines, because you have these long extended oners. So it was a good thing to learn how to essentially work with actors to make sure that they essentially properly block certain scenes and they understand what they're trying to say and get them comfortable to do these 3 or 4 minute scenes. Like Into the Forest, we had multiple scenes that were 3 or 4 minutes long that were essentially oners, and you can't cut those up because it is found footage. So you had to figure out a way to work with actors to make them comfortable and make sure they're rehearsed so that they can get to that moment where they essentially can give you a very good 3 to 4 minute performance. It's at this point, found footage is very close to almost like theater work, where you really can't mess up. So I think understanding how to get a performance out of the actors at this point allows me to work better with going back to cinematic, because with cinematic, you have cuts and you can, you know, manipulate the actor's footage. But just having the experience of oners and incorporating oners in our cinematic universe was a big learning phase for us. It allowed me to work with the actors and understand how to actually get this performance out of them, which is always beneficial when you're going back to cinematic.
Yeah, I definitely agree with those points. You know, just kind of go through them real quick. And again, another thing I just really want to highlight, I am being turned around to the concept of found footage, mainly because of the super fans' feedback. Consistently, they've said, you know, Into the Forest, we love it. They said The Haunted of the Suicide House, which is my least favorite, And people are like, nope, that's my favorite. Love it. It's the best. Goes back to the thing. Hey, whatever I like is what I like, and I'm correct. Whatever they like is what they like is correct. But I cannot deny the amount of people that really do enjoy found footage. Just recently I saw there's a found footage group in Facebook that reposted our movie. Like, so there is a good audience for it. I think it kind of was a testament to why, you know, The Haunting of the Suicide House was our best performing one. And with that being said is, you know, you're not your audience, go find your audience. I think this is why, even though I'm not a fan of found footage, I'm ready to do another one. I'm ready to basically say that you need to look at it as an option for an indie filmmaker. It will reduce the budget. You do get forgiven for a lot of the errors and the issues that pop up with cinematic. And if you're able to basically go ahead and execute on that, it really gives you a good idea and a good blueprint. So, you know, found footage, I think everyone should look at it, especially if you're in the horror genre. You have basically a built-in crowd there. And I think one of the reasons, though, is, you know, since it is a lower quality that is basically accepted just for the nature of it, it is something where I think since I watched a lot of the indie found footages, that kind of what, you know, put me off, because you can definitely see the difference there. So with that being said, you know, you're going to have an audience. I think it's something that every indie filmmaker should explore, especially if you're in the horror side of things. The woods, absolutely terrifying. Another thing is POV pop scares. So POV pop scares is something with the woods too as well that really kind of highlights, you know, just how you can have additional scare power to just a normal indie film set. And I think that's something that, you know, we started to see with Into the Forest. That being said, filming in the forest has its own set of problems, you know, just getting things out there, batteries. We talk about it all in our End of the Forest podcast episode, going through basically what it was like with that process. So be sure to check that one out if you haven't listened to it. And then, you know, lastly, yeah, the fact that we had a really strong acting crew for End of the Forest. Not to say that we've, you know, had bad crews, but they really did a great job with those extended scenes, because those are very, very tough. And those are things where I think it's kind of that double-edged sword where, yeah, it's something where when you do pull it off, it looks really, really good. It flows really natural. And they did a fantastic job with it. And that's awesome and amazing. And when you can capture it, it makes the editing process even easier as well too. But with that being said, it also probably brings up the other double-edged sword, which is, you know, if you don't have that ability to get through that scene, you're really leaving your actors high and dry. It can leave them open to just a lot of, you know, poor takes, in the sense that, you know, when you're doing cinematic, you're taking the best of the best. So with that being said, what are kind of the three negatives that we started to uncover with found footage and Into the Forest?
Yeah, I think the main issue with Into the Forest was the screenplay was just all over the place. And when I say the screenplay was all over the place, there's just too many villains, or the plot wasn't essentially clear, where we had this really cool ending, but people didn't understand what was going on. So we had a crazy redneck guy threatening the main characters. We had multiple people tell the main characters that the woods are essentially haunted. And we had a Nelson character who essentially lost his daughter out there as sort of like a wild card. You didn't know what he was trying to do. Did he really kill his daughter or not? All this stuff is never very clear. And so when we go out to get to the third act, we have the witch essentially making noises in the woods. We have the little daughter that Nelson lost show up. It's never really clear essentially who the main villain of the movie is. So when you finally get to the climax, which, spoiler alert, is almost like a shape-shifting witch who becomes one of the main characters, that ending never hits because everyone was just so confused on what was going on. Now, it was very clear in my head, it was very clear in the writer's head when we wrote this screenplay, exactly what was going on. But that didn't translate to the feedback we were getting to when we actually shot it. So I said one of the negatives was, you know, there's just too many red herrings, or there's too much going on with the plot. It just needed to be condensed. If we would have essentially picked one of those three or four different plot lines and just really hammered down and focus on them, I think this movie would have been really, really good. But the fact that we kind of, you know, used all of them and kind of watered it down and essentially made the ending not as good as it could have been really hampered essentially the overall story arc of this movie. The next thing was you have to be very careful with the acting. I thought, you know, myself as directing this was, it just wasn't very good as far as like the characters' interactions. So we have the two main characters are supposedly brother and sister, but a lot of the feedback that we got from the people who watched this movie was the brother and sister almost seemed to have like a romantic involvement with each other. They had a lot of chemistry, but it was not brother and sister chemistry. It was kind of like romantic chemistry. And this was kind of an issue where a lot of people were like, why, if these people are brother and sister, do they have like this romantic chemistry? And it's a fair point. And when I go back and look at it now, I can see what they're saying. So it's something where I learned like to really be careful if you're doing, you know, or if you're directing characters, to make sure that, you know, if they're brother and sister, it's very platonic. You have to make it very clear, and you have to almost make it over the top to just make sure that these characters understand their relationship. And especially it's, you know, it's not very clear, especially if you're bringing actors in who are not brother and sister, you know, obviously they want to build chemistry with each other. You just have to make sure it's the right chemistry. So once again, this probably goes back to pre-production and, you know, just making sure they understand their roles and both actors understand, you know, the lines that they're going to be delivering are in a certain way. But it was just something that we needed to make sure that people understood that it was a platonic relationship, it was brother and sister, as opposed to, you know, being romantically involved. And this is the first time we had, I think, a script that involved brother and sister, as opposed to either boyfriend or girlfriend. So it was something new to us at the time. And obviously we didn't execute it as well as we could have, but, you know, moving forward, especially with like examples like in the murder house where everyone is platonic, it was a learning lesson that we needed to just go back and just reevaluate. So my advice would be is if you do have brother and sister characters or characters that are platonic in the relationship, just make sure that they understand that and the lines that you're giving them are, you know, can essentially emphasize that point as opposed to, you know, trying to make them romantically involved. The next thing would be, you know, once again, the people just didn't understand this plot. And I think that not only do we have a lot of plot lines in this, we didn't reiterate the plot line throughout the movie. And this is the first time we really realized that you have to tell the audience the plot line three or four different times and make it very clear what the plot line is. This monster does this, this, you know, these are the rules of the world that you're doing. And this is what's going to happen if you obey these rules or if you disobey these rules. So for the Into the Forest movie, it was, this is a witch. She shapeshifts into different people, living or dead. And you should essentially leave the forest or she's going to kill you. And she's going to kill you by transforming into other characters or people that you know. She can essentially shapeshift. And we never brought that up. So then once again, we had this really cool ending and it never really hit because we never made it clear the rules of the world that we were operating in. And the rules of the villain, which is essentially the witch in our story, we never really made that clear how she was operating in her, essentially her goals and her motivations as like the villain of the story. So you have to really do that. And if you don't do that, your audience is going to be, they're just going to be lost. And the more times you can do it, it may seem like a lot to you as a screenwriter or a director, but it just turns out that the more times you have to do it, the better, because when you're writing the screenplay and you're directing the screenplay, you're so far in the woods that you can't see the trees, and your audience will not understand that as well as you understand it. And a lot of this, like a lot of the stuff that you do as far as like body language or just character interaction in your head may make a lot of sense, but it will not come off to the viewers. So once again, like this big thing that we learned from this one was just reiterate the plot 3 or 4 times and make sure it's super clear heading into that third act so that the audience understands it. Because if it's not clear at that time, you're doing a lot of different stuff, you know, you're going to have a lot of problems, and you can have the best end in the world, but if people don't understand it up until that point, you know, it's going to fall flat, and you're just not going to, you're going to have a lot of confused people, and you're going to have a lot of negative reviews.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really does sum it up. And to kind of wrap them all into one, in my opinion, is, you know, what you highlighted at first, which is just, this was the first one that we got to focus on the story. You know, we got to get through all the technical difficulties because it was found footage, so people would look past that. And with that being said, what they would do is they would look into the story. And I think it goes back to this really helped us shape all the stories moving forward, especially after The Haunting of the Suicide House. Again, we filmed Into the Forest and The Haunting of the Suicide House within like a 3-month period. So we never got to that final end product review. And basically they suffered from the same issues, but they made the issues really apparent. And again, it comes down to a few things with, you know, like you're saying, people didn't understand the plot. We had a very wide plot with an entire background. We had a witch that had a name. It was Greta Van something. And then she had a code of Skigix. She had the Devil's Bible. She ended up capturing kids. She sacrificed the kids. And then now people get abducted. They get abducted if they're not there with someone else. And then on top of that, it's basically something where now they possess her and they like get her because she's spiritual. So there's all of these things that end up happening when in reality you should just pick one and, like you said, hit it 2 or 3 times and just really go into it. And it's something we go into on our other podcast where we basically say, you know, you have to say it 3 to 4 times, because when was the last time you just watched a movie without going on your cell phone? And if you miss the dialogue, and as a writer and director, as you were saying, you're so far in it that you're like, well, of course. And you're almost like, I'm treating the audience like they're dumb. And you're not. You just have to understand attention spans in the sense of you want to overdo it in as strategic of a way as you can. You know, and that's why we try and up the ante every time. But the best thing you can do is have an entire plot dump right before your finale, just to say, hey, just to give you guys an idea, this is why this is happening. This is why we're moving forward. And I think that's something that really showed us with these two of them. And then to kind of touch on, you know, the relationship element, I think one of the issues with that was you almost, you know, you pick characters. And if you think about it, when we have the character, the female lead is kind of in the middle. Her brother is pulling her to do, you know, the thing that's kind of risky for the payoff. And her boyfriend is trying to make her safe. And what ends up happening is the person that's pulling her to the risky element has to be fun and playful. So the dialogue and everything that we have is a lot more fun and playful because that's just naturally his character. And that's almost kind of where you can see it, where, you know, be careful of the characters that you choose and the roles that they play, because there's a lot of real playful elements, but also a lot of the stuff that we cut out, they had a lot of fighting elements to it where they would like bicker as well. That was something we actually pulled back on. So I do agree. It's something where when you're casting the characters, not even what their relationship is, but just understand, you know, how that character, because almost Nick might've been better just to be the boyfriend. And, you know, the brother's the really, like, steady-headed one. Like, honestly, that's how I would look at redoing it now. Because I think you just got to understand what the dynamic is with the relationships they have. So, you know, the biggest one to me is really the story. But it's something where people love Into the Forest. And it's going to be one that we look at remaking. So, you know, that's the power of found footage. And with that, we powered through and made our most successful movie, the easiest movie, and the movie I personally don't like the most. But again, you know, it's out there for the audience. So The Haunting of the Suicide House. You know, as I mentioned, it's something where I'm warming up to it more and more now. You know, people like found footage. It's just a taste thing. But it was super easy to film. It was super easy to market. It did a great job. And we were done really quickly. Like, this was one of the easiest shoots that we've ever had. What were some of your overall feelings and everything, just kind of where The Suicide House lies for you now?
Yeah, I think the main takeaway from The Suicide House was that the production was super smooth. The production manager and the PA that helped me with this one did an excellent job. We found the location, finding the actors was great. We were able to black out the building, essentially the house that we're in, so that, you know, we were able to shoot from 7 a.m. to, you know, 1 or 2 at night, but we were able to do it, you know, with blackout, you know, windows, because most of the movie takes place at night. So I made a very smooth shoot. I think it was like 5 or 6 days. There was never any point on this production where I felt stressed that we wouldn't get it done. There were no issues. The actors came in super professional. They knew what they were trying to do. And the script is pretty straightforward. So there wasn't anything, you know, major issues with the production. So I'd say, like, we learned how to really do a found footage production with this one, and to make it super smooth and, you know, be able to just maximize our days by blacking out one location, because I think it was my office. And then we did like one little apartment scene, but the 90% of the movie was done in one location. So it was super smooth. And I think that was like my main takeaway from this one, was just how easy it was to do a found footage movie and how easy it is to do with one location without any like major location moves. So then the next thing was, like, we had a couple good pop scares with this one. I thought the garage scare with Kai was really good. So that's something we used in like the murder house, and we continue to move. And I think a lot of people like the electrical cord scare, which is like brought up in some feedback meetings that we had with the murder house. People were like, this is a really cool scare. And this was before we were getting feedback from the super fans, but a lot of super fans thought that this was a pretty good scare. So I think we did have a lot of good scares in there. I thought we did a lot of cool stuff in there. I think the intro was really good in this one. So there was a lot of stuff that we could look back on scare-wise or beat-wise that I thought were really good. And then let me look here. I thought the intro was very good. It was engaging. It was fast. It was quick. It gave you just a little bit of a glimpse of what we were trying to do. And I thought the ending with her like burning down the house was really cool. It kind of gave you essentially closure to all the shit that happened. So I think, like, once again, the most important thing in an indie film, or just any film in general, is the intro and the ending. And I thought that we did a really good job with the intro. We gave just enough to get you hooked in there without giving away everything. And the ending was just enough to give you enough closure to be like, all right, this is a full circle movie. We're from start to finish. And I feel completed, or at least I feel enough to that my time that I invested in this movie was good. So I think those are the three things that I really took away from The Suicide House.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly something where it goes back to it. And even when I was talking about it, you know, I always mentioned it was something that we understood our budget. We understood how to make it easy. We understood how to get it done. I mean, even before, like, even going into the forest, we always knew, okay, well, we got to pick up another one. It's got to be an easier one. We got to make sure it's quick, it's paced good. Boom, there's The Haunting of the Suicide House, and we executed on it. And, you know, also something is, it's really, really easy to get the editing process done through and to just plow through those found footage movies. So that's really something where I think it showed us not only the budget, but then, as you mentioned, what we executed on is the intro and the climax. So if you're, this was really kind of a very, very good, you know, minimal viable product in the sense of pushing out the DBS model. We understood the budget, we kept it low. We understood the intro and the climax needed to be good. That's where we focused our attention, and we did execute on those. We had the closure, as you were mentioning. We had very strategic production value, like here or there with a few locations, but mainly it was one location, as you said, and it did work. You know, it's one of those things where what ends up happening is if you set yourself up for success in the pre-production, production is easy, post-production is easy, and you make your money back. And as a filmmaker, especially a filmmaker that wants to keep making films, that's by far the most important thing. So, you know, again, I cinematic critique wise, I still hold my own beliefs. Super fans absolutely love it. We remade the idea with the haunting of the murder house in the sense of taking it. And then from there, it really ended up being something where, you know, I think it was such a great benefit in the sense of what we were able to learn and how the, you know, motivation it gave us to get through a project that easy. So that being said, what were the three things that were kind of the issue when it comes to what we ended up making?
I think it's something that we still struggle with today, which is the overall atmosphere of the movie. And I think this is one of the most difficult things for indie films to essentially figure out and tackle, which is just the overall tone and atmosphere of the movie. And you really need a good budget behind you to make this happen, because you need good set design, you need good actors, you need good camera, you need good lighting to really set the tone and get this like dark, foreboding mood to your movie. That's because we're obviously doing horror stuff, to give it that overall tone. And the fact that we had the lights on in this movie is very bright. It just kind of lost like that horror movie feel to it. You know, you never had the tension of like something really could bad happen or something that bad could really happen because the lights are on. You kind of felt safe. It just, the home looked very renovated. It was essentially like a home that just got flipped. So it looked very nice and new. There's nothing spooky about it. So it just goes back to like making sure you have set design or you're picking a location that's very spooky, but also like just turn the lights off and really make sure your lighting is on point as far as like your contrast ratios on the face, or just making sure that everything's done in low light. If you're going to do a found footage movie, make sure the lights are turned off. And the only light that you have is essentially your flashlight. Is going to be big time, you know, things that we learn from this movie. And I think that the movie itself was very simplistic as far as it was one location. There really wasn't a lot of depth to the characters. There wasn't a lot of depth to the story. And any kind of depth that we actually added was detrimental because it was so, there's so many different plot lines that we kind of strung out that we had so many different threads that the viewer could choose from. It just made it difficult for, you know, people to follow along. And then when they did follow along, it was just a very simplistic plot. There wasn't a lot of spice to it. And yeah, we had a good ending and we had a good intro, but the middle parts were just, you know, they weren't very engaging. They weren't very cool. And if anything, they were very confusing. And then, you know, the storyline, once again, coming back to it, just had too many threads. It was, you know, who is the person who got killed in this house? Then we had like a plot line about the girl drowning a whole bunch of people. Then we had like another person getting killed in the house. We didn't make it clear whether it was a possession movie or was it a devil or a demon that was like making, you know, people possessed in this house. Nothing was very clear. So like when Kai actually gets possessed, you're like, well, is it a ghost? Is it a demon? I don't know, like, what's actually doing it. And then when he actually gets possessed, you don't know the rules of the story. So you don't know if, like, if he's possessed, is he going to go kill them? Like, what's going to, is he just dead? Like, what's going to happen? None of this really made sense. And I think we learned a lot of this, and we made a lot of progress in our next movie, The Murder House, where we're like, all right, look, this is a possession movie. These are the rules of this world. This is what's going to happen if you actually mess with, you know, the demon in this realm. So I think that was the main takeaway, was like the screenplay wasn't very clear on the rules. It wasn't very clear of exactly what happened. And it wasn't clear on like what happens if you actually break into this house and you actually start messing with the forces of evil in this house, what actually happens to you. So you have to make it very clear, is if you're going to violate these rules, if you're going to do something bad, you know, what are the consequences of your actions? And that was never very clear in the screenplay. So when people, you know, finished this movie, it wasn't very satisfying, because they were like, well, I never understood what was going on. So yeah, he was possessed, but I never really understood what was essentially going on in this movie. I don't know why he was possessed, and, you know, why would he essentially kill his friends? So those are all very big notes that we took. We took that feedback. And obviously The Murder House is the 2.0 version of this. And you can see our progress in that one, you know, when it releases.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, as we mentioned from the last one, the biggest takeaway to me from both of these movies, Into the Forest and The Haunted Suicide House, was the idea of you have to really be crystal clear with the story, in the sense of picking a plot and reiterating it three times, explaining exactly what it was. Because again, it was the same thing. You know, we had a wide plot, in the sense of, you know, there was Rosemary, her husband drank, she drowned her baby, she then possessed someone, there was a murder, and then there is another daughter, she heard voices, she killed her parents, and now they're there. We explained all of that, but, you know, again, if you miss one part of it, then boom, there goes your entire chain of thread there. And, you know, what was crazy to me is with, you know, The Haunted of the Suicide House, people were like, I wish there was actually a plot. And it's like, well, there is a plot. And they're like, oh, I just didn't notice, because we didn't drive home the same three points. And again, if you can, you know, execute on having a budget like we did, and then also execute and explaining what the plot is, there you go. There's your movie. And, you know, there's your most successful chance at making a profit back. So I do agree with that. The other big thing, you know, as I kind of mentioned all the time, is, yeah, why don't we just turn the lights off? If you're making a horror movie, if you're making a film, just turn the lights off. It looks spookier. And you know what? We even have like maybe 10, 15 minutes in the dark, and it looks way better. If you literally just kept the lights off, kept the lights to minimal, you would have improved the whole cinematic of that movie by a ton. And I think it's something we, you know, had an issue with The Whitlow House as well too. Morgan Estate's a bit different, but I mean, like, you look at The Murder House, it's dark. You know, you look at Girl in Cabin 13, you have a few light scenes, and then it's dark. And now, you know, we're going to The Shapeshifter, it's going to be dark. Play with the darkness, play with that. The minimal lighting, it just makes it look better. It makes the whole environment there. And, you know, it would have been easy for us just to flip that light switch off. So that's one of the biggest ones for me as well, too. But, you know, if you can reiterate the plot as much as possible, again, you're not belittling your audience. You're simply, you know, driving home what the point is. People want that. People want a solid plot that then they can not only understand the plot, but then they can start guessing and connecting the dots, which is, you know, kind of what everyone wants to try and do on their own. So that wraps up the found footage, you know, escapades that we had. What we're going into now is, again, we didn't really get to the final product on these. These were the two movies that really took us the longest to get through the process, had a whole series of issues. You know, be sure to take a look and listen at the past episodes where we highlight them. But let's go ahead and start with Morgan Estate. You know, to me, it's one where I think these two movies solidified our idea of what a story was, but also opened our eyes to just how to produce movies and what the process needs to look like moving forward. So what do you kind of think about Morgan Estate?
Yeah, Morgan Estate is still probably my favorite movie, just because I think I really like the screenplay. I think there's a lot of potential with the screenplay. Morgan Estate is the first one where I had been working on this screenplay for almost years before we even started shooting films. This was one of my favorite screenplays, and I was kind of holding off onto it until I had a better idea of, you know, how to make a production and how to make sure a production runs smoothly. So I was kind of holding it in my back pocket, and I do like the screenplay. I do think the story was one of our better stories. It had a good intro. It had a good hook. It had a good ending. So I was really happy with how the screenplay turned out. Now it's super indie, and we had a lot of production issues with this script, but for the most part, you can see what we were trying to do. And it's very clear. And, you know, the story is pretty solid. There wasn't a lot of confusion with this movie. So I think my main takeaway was, like, this was the first time we wrote a screenplay that people enjoyed and people understood, and there wasn't a lot of screenplay issues. The second thing that I took away from this was, like, the production value that you can get from having different locations. We had a beautiful mansion out on a lake in South Orlando, Florida. It added to the production value immensely because we had the lake and we had all these different rooms and everything was really cool. It essentially looked like an estate. We had like a little lake shooting scene. We had an office scene, which was my office. So moving different locations, all of them were high quality, just added to the production value of the overall set and the overall tone of the movie. So I think that was the first time I was like, all right, like, you know, outside of maybe The Invited, this was the best locations that we had before. So it was just like, hey, you know, if you have the opportunity to get better locations, try and do that, you know, because you're just production value, the extra couple $100 you can spend on, you know, finding nicer locations will turn, you know, will return your money immensely in your final product if you can find really cool locations or locations that are shootable that look very, very good. Then the final thing was, like, we really learned how to do like red room scenes or scenes with very aggressive light bulb or gel situations. So we had a lot of scenes in there where she was in a red room. So it was very red. And it looked really, really cool. So I think using gels is something that you can do. And you have to be very, very careful with this. You can't use gels in just regular situations. But when the time comes, like a red room scene or a photography development scene like we had in this movie, I think the gels and understanding how they operate can give you a really, really cool look. I'd love to do scenes with flares or very red, coloring in one scene would be great. Or like an emergency flashing light that's red would be a really cool scene. Cause it gives you dynamics. It gives you dynamic range and it just looks really good. So it's a cheap way to, hack production value to make you look like a cinematic movie. So I thought that was really good. And I thought that we did a really good job with montages. Like we had a lot of photography montages, her chopping up photography or, you know, essentially going through the development phase of developing photographs. I thought we did a really good job with that. And then she has a really cool montage in there where she's trying to figure out who essentially died and the missing person that was in the story. And the research montage in that cut with a printer was really, really cool. So I say that, you know, we learned how to do montages. And if you're an indie filmmaker, montages are going to be your bread and butter because they're very easy to do. You can control the pace and the plot line and also give your audience a lot of information in a really cool sequence, and they're very easy to shoot. if you can't get them done, they're very easy to pick up. So I'd say like, those are the things that we really learned how to do. As far as like montages and figuring out how to really move the pace and tell the story of the movie in an engaging way through montages and, you know, red room and different colored scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I really do agree with that. And while we did discuss, and you know, I'm sure in the cons, some of the issues with like production value and things of moving around and what we ran into, what you're mentioning is completely correct. I mean, if you can show the production of having multiple locations, having different scenes, having those things, really, you know, anything you can do to pull someone away from them thinking it's, you know, an indie feature, is just going to tremendously help you with what their overall opinion is. You know, once they start seeing and noticing things, start to pick it apart. And one way to easily do it is to have those different locations. Also, you know, I thought we did have some scenes, like you were saying, that had really good lighting to them. You know, the garage scene in the finale looks really, really well. So there's a lot of different things that you can do to basically cheat that look. And, you know, while it was something where a lot of the issues were just kind of making it work, once it finally worked, it looks really good. You know, it looks like a good movie. So it is one of those things where being strategic and, you know, as you always mentioned, you got to try and find how you can cheat your way to that $1 million movie look. You know, I think we really started to understand a lot of different things there. And I also think, you know, we really had the plot solidified and we're starting to understand pacing. You know, I think this was the first time we had the lore dumps, you know, where we kind of said, hey, we're going to talk about the plot 3 times. And then, as you mentioned, we started learning what the montage is. This is an easy way to connect the dots and to push that pacing. Always say pacing is like the number one thing with movies. So that's really where you want to continue to push it. And montages are a great way to do it. So that being said, you know, as we mentioned in our past podcasts, this was a tough one. This was a real burden of a movie to get done, to get finished. It really kind of forged us in the fires of editing just to get the thing done and finalized. But what were the top 3 things that, you know, really kind of showed us, oh man, we got to avoid doing this again?
Yeah, for this one, it was just pickups. We left this shoot with a lot of issues. And I knew leaving this shoot that we're going to have a lot of problems, but they really didn't get discovered until we started editing them. There was a lot of issues with transition scenes. There was a lot of issues with just shots that we needed to do. We needed to pick up scares. So, I mean, my main takeaway from this one was like, make sure you don't do pickups. And, you know, just make sure if you have to do pickups that they're simple and you can understand. It's like mainly over the shoulder stuff or pickups that you don't need one of the main actors. And we got very creative with this one because we didn't fly the main actor or actress back. So we had a lot of hands, we had a lot of feet, and we got very creative on how to pick it up. But my main thing was, don't ever do that. You know, try and avoid that at all costs, because, you know, doing pickups not only gives you a sense of, it doesn't give you the sense of urgency. It gives you like, all right, you know, I'm not going to really work on this movie until we get the final pickups. So you have a sense of just being relaxed. And I think we saw this in the Murder House where we had a good cut going, but we never really finished it until I got the final, you know, pickups. And it's an excuse you can tell yourself. You're like, all right, well, I can't really do anything until I get these final pickups. And that's just not something where you want to be. You should have the entire movie completed, and then you should go back and get the pickups and put them, you know, in your timeline. So anytime you do pickups, I think it's kind of an excuse. And it's only going to delay everything that you're going to try and do. And, you know, I've learned this. I know this. I know this is a fact. And I tell myself every time that, you know, pickups, finish the movie, and then we can go back and do the pickups. And it never really happens like that. You know, I look back at the editing timeline. I'm like, all right, listen, I'm just going to wait until we get the final pickups. it's just, this is what happens. So as an indie filmmaker, if you want to get your movie done in a respectable timeline, make sure you don't do pickups. Or if you're going to have to do pickups, make sure you're editing the movie completely all the way through start to finish without having to do those pickups, or at least waiting for those pickups to just insert later on, because it is an excuse. And, you know, as an indie filmmaker, any kind of excuse to not to delay your product or not put it up, you know, is going to be an excuse that you're going to make. And I've done 11 of these movies, or I've done 10, I'm about to do 11. And I am all about making things quick, and I'm all about making things fast, and I still fall into these same pitfalls. So it doesn't change. You just have to be aware of it, and you have to make sure that you're, you know, actively trying to make sure you do not have pickups. The other thing that we had with this one was, you know, the screenplay was just very lengthy with dialogue. A lot of the stuff that we had, a lot of the feedback that we got was, you know, our characters don't have enough depth. And that's like, okay, fine. We're going to give them a whole bunch of backstory. We're going to give them a whole bunch of character depth. You know, these are going to be likable characters. And, you know, when we shot on the screenplay, it seemed very logical. Everything seemed very good. I was like very happy with how the characters came out on the screenplay. I was like, these are very likable characters. They have good motivations. Everything seems excellent. When we shot that stuff and I went to edit it, it was just like, man, they say the same things over and over again. They're not very likable. And a lot of these scenes are just very dialogue heavy and very character develop heavy. And they just take forever to get through. So I think that was a major issue with the screenplay, which is it was very character and drama heavy, where we had 6 or 7 minute scenes of characters explaining to them each to themselves or to the other character exactly what they're trying to do. And you don't want that because it's super boring. So you need to make sure that if you're going to explain your characters, do it in a way that's engaging, and essentially try and do it in a way that they can do it through their actions, as opposed to sitting there for 6 or 7 minute scenes and just dumping all this dialogue and character development to the audience. And then finally, there's a lot of audio issues. Once again, use law of mics, or if you're going to have a boom operator, make sure they understand what they're trying to do. Because going back through this took me probably 120, 140 hours of fixing up this audio. And it was terrible. And audio fixing up is the worst thing you could possibly do. It's super painstaking, and it really, really sucked. So at this point, I was like, all right, listen, we should really make sure that we get better audio and, you know, it's coming into the camera properly, because, you know, if you're having these huge dialogue scenes that we actually happen to have, you want to make sure that people can hear it and they can understand it and it doesn't sound like they're essentially underwater.
Yeah. I mean, those really do kind of encapsulate major issues. And I'm glad you started off with the pickup ones, because I think one of the challenges that I have, you know, just for us in general for the next one is let's finish without pickups, because it slows it down. It really does. You know, we had it happen with Girl in Cabin 13, where we just wanted to pick up the finale, and basically we had the cut up until that point. But then it gives you an excuse not to color. It gives you an excuse not to add sound in there. It gives you an excuse because you don't have picture lock. You know, like you're saying, this is just time that it takes. And the movies that we ended up finishing without any pickups, which were basically our found footage movies, they got out the door. The movies that needed the most pickup, it took a year and a half. And I mean, that's something that got suffered from both of our movies at this stage, is we just ended up having to do a ton of pickups to get it done. So, you know, really give yourself more time than, you know, you think you need. You know, back to what you're saying with like a lot of the lengthy dialogue and whatnot, that's why it's, you just got to play around with, you know, just kind of what works best for you, the way to establish a backstory, the way to kind of do this. And you only get that by understanding the basics first. And I think really what kind of did give us a bit more of a help with it is people understood the plot, but the characters were still kind of here or there. So as long as they understood the plot, we're getting better. We can develop the characters more. And, you know, I think it still is something, you know, we say a lot, you know, our actors get a little bit of flack for us just, you know, still learning what we're doing when it comes to just making a character likable, unlikable, or, you know, whatever they need to hit home as. Because again, that's a difficult craft. So that's it. But, you know, the end thing is, man, if you don't have audio issues and you don't have video issues, you're set for a lot better experience in post. You know, we go into it in detail, but these are something that's going to happen. You don't have the luxury, you don't have the time to, you know, get enough footage, to get enough takes to ensure that no matter what, you have a good take. And if you find yourself in that, you know, position and you don't have the ability to use clips because of audio or video issues, you are so putting yourself in such a, you know, with as little takes as you're having already, you're putting yourself in such a disadvantage. So that's something to really kind of think of. And again, as we kind of mentioned, I think a lot of the same issues occurred in The Devil in the Room when it comes to, you know, having to pick things up, not having certain elements to it. And the main thing, as we say always, is we didn't finish the Morgan estate. So we didn't see these clear issues that we would have likely avoided. And that kind of leads us to, you know, the three things we like, the three things we don't like with our final movie in The Hateful Eight, The Devil in the Room. So for me personally, I love The Devil in the Room. I love the plot. I'm more of a lore person. You know, yeah, it has its issues here, mainly the intro, mainly the climax, which guess what? That means you have two major glaring issues that come up. But with that being said, I want to revisit it. You know, it's also one that requires a much higher budget, but I really like the idea of dreams. You know, it's something we talked about. Dreams can be a very effective way to do scares. And I think it's just a fun world to play in. So I'm still a big fan of it. It's my favorite of The Hateful Eight. With that being said, it did the worst. So, you know, my taste is really off there. But what do you think, you know, overall about The Devil in the Room, you know, our final of The Hateful Eight?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was never comfortable with this script. You know, I didn't think if I didn't have such a good PA that set this whole thing up in motion very easily, as far as like the location and getting the actors, I would have never made this movie. But she did such a good job that I was like, all right, I'm going to try it. And I think this is good advice to any filmmaker. Or if you're on the fence on whether you should actually shoot it or just, you know, skip it or give it more time, I would always lean on shooting it, because I did learn a lot from this movie, and we did upload this movie, and the movie is still making money to this day. I think that's a very beneficial thing for filmmakers, where no matter what movie you're going to do, you know, it's never going to be perfect. And there's always excuses you can make to not finish it or not start shooting it. So I think if you were to lean on it, even if you're not comfortable with the screenplay, if you're not comfortable with the actors, if you're not comfortable with the production, if you can get it done, my advice would be to get it done, because you're going to learn from it. It may not be the best thing you're ever going to make, but you're going to learn from it. And that would sum up, you know, The Devil in the Room for me. Was I was never comfortable about it, but I shot it. And honestly, the feedback from it was so beneficial that I learned more from The Devil in the Room than most of the other movies. So, you know, if you were to go back and you were to ask me again whether or not I should shoot it, 100%. I think it's one of the reasons we are where we are right now, was because I shot this movie. It allowed me to learn so much that we made Girl and Captain 13, and that movie was so much better as far as production, just because of the things that I learned from, you know, The Devil in the Room. And I think it kind of propelled us into the next level as a film company. So that being said, I think we did an extremely, extremely good job explaining a very, very difficult plot. We had to explain essentially Frank the Demon. We had to explain the lore behind the world. We had to explain the rules of the dream world. We had to explain two characters, and we had to explain like the lore of like the totem and Dr. Gubeau. this was extremely difficult to explain, and it was extremely difficult to dump on the audience. And honestly, I think we did a really good job. The feedback from this movie was people understood it. They understood what was going on, and they understood the ending, which was, you know, a next milestone for us, because this is such a, this script is so crazy, and there's so many different things in this script. To have people follow it was almost like a miracle in itself, where people couldn't follow the, you know, the two found footage movies, which, you know, were found footage and they kind of just were very linear and they moved. The fact that they were able to follow this movie with how much crazy, you know, stuff is going on in the movie was just, I think, a milestone as far as like our storytelling. And, you know, that was the main takeaway. This one was like, we took a world that we essentially invented ourselves, that nobody else had, and we were able to explain it to the audience, and the audience understood it, was like really, really cool. And I really appreciated that. I thought that this fire pit stuff that we did, once again, fire is like really, really cool. We did a fire pit scene. We did a candle scene. Anytime you can get fire going with your actors, you can kill all the lights and you just have the natural glow. It looks really good. It looks great. My number one tip for indie filmmakers is if you can get someone with candles, or if you get a fire pit scene in there, write it in, because your production value will be that much better just by having fire in your movie. And the last thing was like the intro was really, really good. I thought the intro was solid. I think it just needed a few tweaks as far as like Frank should have showed up in the intro hook. But I thought that, you know, the hairdryer thing was cool. I thought it moved it, you know, the movie, it gave you just enough intrigue to continue watching. And then we hit you with the next scene that where she's like moving around in the kitchen. And we kind of took this from James Wan and the Insidious, where it's a very frantic scene. There's a lot of shaky cam. There's a lot of movement. You're moving around in the scene. It kind of gives you like an engaging look into your characters. And it's just a fun scene as far as like, there's a lot of movement. There's a lot of sound stuff. It's, you know, a high production scene. So going from that, from the intro that I had, to the breakfast scene where she finds out that her sister killed herself and we have like the hard stop, I thought were really cool scenes. I thought the first like 6 or 7 minutes of this movie were very engaging and got people thrust into the next couple scenes where essentially they fell off because it was just too heavy dialogue and there just wasn't a lot of development and we missed on a lot of scares. But I think the first 6 minutes of this movie were very, very solid.
You know, looking back to me, it's something where we just bit off too much than we could chew when it comes to that budget for that size of a movie. It's just, we should not have done it. You need special effects. You need the dream world. You need weird things to go on. And that was just way out of our league. But like you said, we did a really good job of pulling it off. And, you know, we swung for the fences and I think we got like maybe a single, you know, we got people to understand what we were trying to do. People's biggest critique was like, well, yeah, the climax was pretty flat and there was nothing really that, you know, happened scare wise. This is a horror movie. You know, this is your Insidious. This is your spooky, scary. You need some special effects just because it's a demon. It's not a masked person. It's not a possession. It's not some of our other movies where we can kind of cop out that. You need to kind of bring the heat with Frank the Demon. And as good of a job as I did, you know, tilting my head and looking spooky, going to need to do something a little bit more than that. So I think, you know, like you were saying, it is something that it did move. It did have that capability. It looked good with the fire scenes. And we explained the plot, which is really, really important. And, you know, just to see how much we went from people not understanding it with the found footage to people understanding the plot and just the one jump of having those edited, it really made us understand it. So, you know, I would say again, it's something where looking at The Devil in the Room, I wouldn't touch it again until you have like a million plus budget, just because it just requires that. But it is something where, you know, we were able to at least tell the outline, the rough idea of what it was. And with that being said, you know, it suffered a lot of the same issues to some degree with pickups and whatnot. But what were the three major things that we learned when it came to, you know, what we didn't quite execute on?
Yeah, I think the main thing was the script was just very messy. It wasn't very linear. It had a lot of stuff that was just very overly dramatic. So it was just a very overly dramatic script. It was almost something like A24 would make, where it's a very character-driven story. There wasn't a lot of pop scares in there. And the pop scares that we had missed. So I think we just need to cut back on that script and really just try and figure out, like, what were the core aspects of this movie? And how do we really highlight those aspects? We had a lot of issues with, like, the boyfriend character was kind of useless. Honestly, he didn't even be there. And, you know, you had just a lot of stuff as far as, like, the lore goes, and you know, that we had a lot of dialogue scenes with the therapist, and it was just like, if I were to go back to this movie, I'd try and figure out exactly what we were trying to do and, you know, really hone in on it. I think there's just too many dialogue scenes with two characters that just really slowed this movie down. So I think the script was just very messy. It was never like concrete. I never had a really good idea of what I wanted to do. And I think it was just a script that we shot that just maybe was two or three drafts away from being better. But I mean, that being said, like Kel mentioned, I don't know if this movie is just possible at our budget at the time. And I think that there's a lot of stuff we can do very cheaply and very indie, but I think that this one, to tell this story like we wanted to, was just not feasible for our budget. And I think that might've been the biggest issue, is that we're trying to shoot for a movie outside of our essentially comfort zone, or our zone of attack, or, you know, the zone that we can actually live in. So I think that was the biggest thing, is like the screenplay was just too big for essentially our budget at the time. And, you know, it kind of shows. The next thing was like the pop scares are very cheap. We tried to do some pre-production on the pop scares, but most of them just were not very good. And when you miss a pop scare, you're missing a beat, and it's going to take you another 6 or 7 minutes to get another beat or pop scare. And if you miss on two pop scares, you're going to have a lot of issues. So we had a lot of heavy dialogue scenes. We had a small pop scare that we missed on. We had a heavy dialogue scene. We had a small pop scare that I missed on. We had a heavy dialogue scene. So now you're like 30 or 40 minutes into this movie, and you've had 30 or 40 minutes of just pure dialogue and very little horror. And our audience is horror. They want pop scares. They want to be feel creepy. They want atmosphere. We never gave that to them. And they're just like, all right, I'm done with this. If this is another therapist scene, I'm done with this. If this is another character development scene, I'm done with this. And they just essentially turn the movie off. So this was a big thing with like understanding pop scares and making sure that they're their own sequences. So they lead up from 1 minute to 8 minutes, and making sure that you give them the time, and then making sure that they hit, because if they don't, you're going to have a movie like The Devil in the Room, which just is already heavy on character development. It's only going to get worse. And then finally, like, there's a lot of audio issues with this one. There's a lot of post-production issues with this one. There's a lot of video issues with this one. And it's just making sure that your audio that you're getting into the camera is very, very clear, that the frame and essentially picture that you're getting in through the camera is the one you want. So you don't have to readjust in post. And, you know, just making sure your overall production quality as far as like color, sound, and everything else is solid and it's coming to the camera how you want it. Because anytime you have to change that, it's going to take you a lot of effort and time in post-production. And this one was just kind of a mess as far as like audio, as far as picture. I had to go and reframe a lot of stuff. And it just adds to a lot of issues and adds to a lot of problems in post-production. Take the 5 minutes to make sure you're getting good audio. Take 5 minutes to make sure that the framing in your camera is the one that you want. Take 5 minutes to make sure your white balance is proper and the color palette that you want and the LUT that you want is in the camera. So you don't have to fix that stuff in post. Because there's just so, this movie almost took us 8 months in post-production to fix up because we were not getting the proper amount of sound, framing, and color, and like the essentially the look that we wanted to get in the camera in the first place. If you can just get all that stuff in the camera, you don't have to worry about it in post, and it'll be so much better. And your time frames from post-production, which I think most indie films struggle with, will be, you know, so much more condensed than it would be as if you're going back and trying to fix all these issues.
Yeah, I mean, to me, again, it goes back to what's really interesting with this one is I feel like we hit the hard part of kind of getting the plot. The easy part of kind of having the pop scares and special effects, we just didn't have the budget for. So if you got hooked by the devil in the room, the concept behind it with the demon and our blurb and everything like that, you're expecting a horror movie. And we don't show you Frank the Demon until like 25 minutes into it. And it's just me in a mask. So it's really not quite there. So I definitely agree where it's something where that's why we saw a lot of people tune out of it. Because we didn't deliver on basically what we were telling them. We're telling them this can be a, you know, supernatural demon flick. But with that being said, the people who did watch it did understand what we were looking at doing. So I think that can really assist in the process of, you know, getting it from point A to point B. But, you know, like you're saying, if you don't have those scares, if you don't have those things that you need to deliver on, then you're already setting yourself up for such an issue. And the only thing people are noticing is then the dialogue, and the dialogue is just going to slow your movie down. And movies are all about pacing. And finally, like you're saying, you know, just having good audio and good video and everything just to a level where you can use all of the footage you film is such a godsend in editing. It gives you so much more room. And there's nothing worse in the editing bay than basically being like, how am I going to make this work? Versus how do I make this the best? Those are two completely different conversations that you have. And they're two completely different styles. And what ends up happening is it takes you a completely different time frame as well. You know, these movies took a while because we had to fix a lot of those issues. And it's just one of those things where, you know, until you understand what it takes to really kind of ensure that process, when you shoot on a condensed time frame, it's easy to make those errors. It's something that's going to happen regardless of the indie film set, regardless of the crew. You know, you just have to take accountability on all sorts of the scope of the production. So that's going to go ahead. That's going to wrap it up for the first 8 movies that we made. Again, we are continuing to make as many movies as we possibly can. Our newest one, The Girl in Cabin 13, is our 9th one. We're going to have The Haunting of the Murder House with us, our 10th. And our 11th movie is about to start filming tomorrow. So we are very excited. You can always take a look at us at a lot of different places online. We have a Discord channel. We have our different YouTube channels and communities as well. But we always want to be the most focused indie studio when it comes to just producing content with our fans. We're casting our super fans, we're working with them, and it's something that we're going to continue to do, especially as we scale up. So be sure to check us out on those different areas. But until we see you again, have a good one.